just stick to the papers is my view. Technology is not my friend. Mr. Fender. Just have a few questions of clarification just arising from some aspects of your evidence that may be of assistance. One, just noting the various roles you've had, and obviously one you mentioned in paragraph 1.5 was you referred to the Waikato River Guardians Establishment Committee, and that you were appointed back in, I don't think what year that might have been, but 2007, 2008, I suspect, to the role of Senior Crown Appointed Advisor to that committee. And I just wanted to touch on that because, as you've said in your evidence, that was a co-governance entity of Waikato and Waikato River and Crown appointees tasked with preparing certificates. But I just wanted to, in terms of those, we've talked about the collaborative process that sits behind probably the development of PC1, but in fact, looking at this, it appears there's a collaborative process that sits behind even the Tuhi Whaimana itself. And I just wondered if you could clarify that those Crown appointees weren't simply representatives of the Crown as such, they represented a range of interests, I understand. Can you ever amplify that?
Absolutely. I'm quite correct that there was a variety of interests, not only across the Crown, but also in terms of the communities as well. It was a co-governance entity, it was co-chaired in that respect. In terms of the collaborative process that we touched on, in terms of the environment and its development, it is related to a process of consultation and engagement with the catchment communities in the form of an opportunity for workshops, submissions, and so on. So, ultimately, what was arrived at was all of our community participate in that process.
And so, it's somewhat different from some of those documents that you see coming out of treaty settlements where they've been kind of drafted in a closed room between the Crown and iwi and kind of imposed upon local authorities and the community. This was through a process that had quite a public face to it.
Again, absolutely. And the river of the GEC was to develop a vision in the Waikato River. So that was the starting point.
Thank you. And that kind of resonates when one looks at the objectives that support the vision, which do emphasise the communities of the river very much so, in addition to the river area. The other thing you referred to in your brief of evidence, you referred to the Waikato River Cleanup Trust that was established through the settlement arrangements, of which the WRA is the sole trustee, and there's a $220 million restoration fund there. But I just wondered, what sat behind that, and I raised this with Ms. May yesterday, was a scoping study that was carried out at the time of the settlement, or during the days of the GEC, perhaps it was, and I was trying to grasp what the figures were in terms of what was estimated may be required, and I wonder whether you had a better recollection than me regarding those details.
No, I don't have a better recollection, so I have your comments, and those questions I mentioned, refreshed my memory by downloading a copy of the summary of the Waikato River Cleanup Trust study, or the RIS, as it was known. It was developed after the development of the shortly before the establishment of the Waikato River Authority, so it was 2009, 2010 period, or November 25, 2010, the current
steps there, but what I thought were the figures, and I suspect they were probably widely inaccurate, but I had a look as well. They were three tiers of figures that were proposed. Can you talk to those?
So the three scenarios, they looked at sort of do nothing, do a little bit, and do quite a bit in terms of the priority actions that they came up with. They recommended the do quite a bit approach. And in terms of the do quite a bit approach, the figure was $4.84 billion to implement that. And I do know that the modeling, the economic modeling was restricted to 30 years after the limitations of the model, but that was the figure that they came up with. And then the other figures sort of ranged between $2 million and $3 million, sorry, to achieve those lower outcomes for the group.
Thank you. Perhaps provides a little bit of context for some of the figures that we've talked about in the first couple of weeks about expenditure, that would be, if you were to fully restore to pristine condition effectively, that's where you're looking at.
That's where they arrived at, and of course mindful that those figures are from 2009 to 2010, so they are somewhat dated, and I would expect, but I'm not an economist, but I think a reasonable assumption to make that those figures are going to be much higher today than what they were.
And that's why, realistically, what's been charted, and I think while it's not the River Authority's 80-year proposal, the River Authority, I think you've indicated in your evidence, acknowledges that that's a reasonable time frame to set things out, having regard to that bigger picture and context.
That's right, Sam, to take, as we know, it's time to achieve 2.5 and realistic. That was initially discussed by the jury 7 to 8 years, and that 8 year was picked up by the River Authority with a realistic approach to adopt. And so that's the time frame that we're going to look into. I might just add that's 8 years from when we were established, not when that was notified, but that's some of the differences.
That's nice. And those things will matter because it's revisited as we make these incremental steps. Timeframes and progress. I was reflecting on the purpose of the authority as stated in the legislation, obviously to set the primary direction through different strategies and to promote an integrated, holistic and coordinated approach to implementation and then the funding of initiatives through the Clean Up Trust. And obviously we've seen the time and the challenges that this process has taken, which is necessarily interlinked with the requirements of the Resource Management Act and its processes. But I did see when, again, looking at your general functions of the authority, there's one paragraph E of section 23, a monitoring obligation, which talks about monitoring the carrying out effectiveness and achievement of the principal function, which is overarching health and wellbeing. Secondly, the implementation, effectiveness and achievement of the vision and strategy, i.e. 235 month, including in targets and methods. So I just wanted to touch on that last reference to targets and methods, because I see in the legislation there are two references, or two primary references to that. Firstly, you've got the authority has the power to review the vision and strategy, to review to 235 month. And may in section 20, subsection 4, recommend that Te Tiri Whai Mana include, firstly, targets to achieve Te Tiri Whai Mana, and secondly, methods to implement Te Tiri Whai Mana, and may recommend other amendments to Te Tiri Whai Mana, and may only make those recommendations for amendments that are consistent with the overarching purpose of the settlement. Now, I also noted that there was provision for a review 3 months after, I think, the enactment of the Act, and one of the things was to consider at that early stage whether targets and methods should be added, and I think the view was taken that it was a little bit too soon to perhaps take that step, and the authority's view was that this thing should bed in a little bit further and allow some of these processes to take their course to see how they're tracking. That's probably a poor description of the principle that's set behind the authority.
I think it's quite a fair description, even though it may be poor. And runs out of these days, but it's hard for me as well. And you co government seems to inform itself at the stage of the agency, in the seal itself up and basically put itself to operate in a public sector finance type role in terms of all the requirements to do that well. But it was felt by the board that within 3 months to embark on a new process to review to 2 to 5 months was perhaps the rock, and decided not to do that because really the focus of the board at that time, if I recall, was essentially getting that sort of awareness across the community that there was a step change in terms of how the world was to be regarded and respected through to 3 to 5 months. So opening up the process to call into question what had been agreed not that long before through the process that you just asked me about in terms of establishing the content of 3 to 5 months seemed impractical.
And I'm just reflecting, obviously, we've had a full talk in the course of this hearing and back before the hearing committee earlier about, you know, what can be done now and what steps need to be taken in the future, and I think everyone has had that very much resource management frame of mind in that regard. But when I look at that monitoring obligation and authority and then power to review and potentially add targets and methods, and without predetermining what the authority may or may not determine to do in the future, undoubtedly the authority will be looking keenly at not only the outcomes of this process and its implementation, but also the relative challenges of it compared to perhaps the authority itself reviewing and developing targets and methods that would have to bite from the top.
You've touched on a few points there.
Yes, sorry, more questions.
I try and take them up there. Why can the effectiveness of 2 to 5 months? And anyone that's been involved in a large scale exploration project understands it's enormously challenging to ascertain the effectiveness of measures when there's a whole bunch of external factors that will bear on what might be applied to achieve the outcomes that have been sought. The authority has a statutory requirement
ultimately any change to fertility farming and types and methods that might be added, as you say, you record it to the Crown on the River Evie, and ultimately if accepted by both of those, or both, all of those parties, then those changes are made by all of the council members.
Absolutely. Yes. And we're going the process that want to avoid a surprise at the end of that process that puts the parties at odds with one another, it would be unhelpful. So we're essentially in a focus on the process with the Crown Court actually to involve much throughout the process of arriving at what may be in the Treaty Prime and the documents that want to do that employee's future decision making. But if there are changes, then there'll be no surprises that those changes are arising through the process.
Thank you. And you mentioned, of course, the process that needs to be followed, which I think is set out Schedule 4 of the Waikato River Settlement Act, that the authority must follow in that regard, and you said that there's some similarities with the Schedule 1 process, but some important differences. And looking at it, I see that there is a need to identify all reasonably practical options for achievement of the overarching purpose and an assessment of those options by considering benefits and costs of each option in terms of present, future, social, economic, environmental and cultural well-being of the communities associated with the river, including the practicable quantification of those benefits and costs, and then again an extent to which Te Tiriti Whānau will be promoted or achieved in an integrated and efficient manner by each option. So, and there's a public submission process that the authority must also follow. So while there are similarities in that, what's quite clear is we're not going through an RMA process in that regard. That's true, isn't it? And in fact, we probably wouldn't be. While not saying that it's obviously those kind of processes are always subject to statutory process to judicial review, there is no provision for kind of appeals and the like as we have, and it consumes large amounts of time and cost. Just the final matter I wanted to just touch on and come back to was the reference to the Cleanup Trust and its responsibilities, and indicated a large amount of work is done and has been funded through that. Obviously, one of the issues that's kind of repeatedly come up here in the course of the hearing has been the cost of fencing and other types of initiatives that might go towards mitigating adverse effects of land use, etc. And I just wonder whether you're able to comment on the extent to which the Trust does or has contributed to those kind of costs in the community, and who's eligible, essentially, for those. Yes, 100 feet is the name that's been restored by 120 feet. we shouldn't have any interest in this, isn't it? I'm seeing wishing to seek any indication of commitment at all. But one of the challenges that's been identified in the course of this hearing is the issue of methodologies and modelling and the accounting system that the Regional Council accepts that has to be established in order to appropriately monitor and maintain clear implications of the movement towards the achievement of attribute states, and also how those matters that can be interlinked with what's happening on farms, for example. And I got the sense from Ms. May that there are always political challenges and budgetary challenges to some of that. And we've also got challenges with finding a replacement or a modification of overseer and other options and challenges and methodologies in that regard. Is that an area that is potentially within the scope of things that the Cleanup Trust could consider contributing to if there was a project? And because it's slightly different from action on the ground as such, but I was just interested. And somebody asked me what I was. Who I won't name. No further questions, thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
Any re-examinations, Your Honour?
No. Questions?
Yes.
Your Honour? That's the problem when you have time to think of questions. Mr. Pinter, just a couple of matters. Just in your evidence sheet, at paragraph 5.6, about the Tuli Whaimana aspiring to restore and protect rather than avoid, remedy and mitigate, and go on to talk about it, the vision being to restore and protect to be a fundamental shift well beyond what's required to achieve sustainability under RMA and a form of government and to supply. I wondered whether or not that was a comment in order to address what's provided for in Policy 5 of the of PC1.
So you're looking to better?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So, and I raised this with Dr. Corcoran from DOC yesterday, where she talked about, in paragraph 77, I'm very interested, altering the order in Policy 5 to first avoid, then minimise, because she says it's not always possible or straightforward to return the environment to the same condition following the disturbance. So I assume you, too, large degree would disagree with that position, because you're looking at restoration as opposed to just holding fort effectively.
Well, that is what's been by vision, that the status quo of configuration doesn't concede for one.
Right, and the only other bit I had, you may have heard me raise the talk in council this afternoon, the issue around the definition of tangata whenua, ancestral land, and I think his response was to talk about expanding the definition to include land, which provided them a process of settlement. So is there an issue about making provision for more than that when looking at the definition of including the general land owned by Māori? I was just wondering if you had a view about that.
In terms of what was outlined by Mr. Dwyer, I think we're quite comfortable with the change in policy. We're quite comfortable with the first refusal that is included in that approach. But I haven't been either thoughts to go beyond that. Probably would not do so without having a conversation with the review.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Panter. First of all, I'd just like to know if people can hear me at the back. Okay, good. I've been told I talk too quietly. My colleagues tell me I talk too much, so it's...
I'm sorry for that as well.
I've just got a couple of questions following up from what I asked Mr. Ryan. And the first one is, one of the things that you're concerned about and we're concerned about is to try and ensure that things move along as quickly as possible. And so one of the things that's going through our mind is, are there certain things that should be prioritised first, so that we say that the, say, lakes were prioritised or something, or certain types of streams were prioritised. I don't know if we can do it, but if we can find a way that does increase the chances of improvements being made sooner, would you support that?
Absolutely. And that's an approach that the authority has taken, so for us to get prepared up for us. We've essentially gone through that exercise in terms of our funding to make sure that's going to be at the most impact rather than just generally. So we've focused on those areas that can support people to achieve one market through a prioritisation process which we developed and published in 2018 in relation to the cleanup opportunities. So I have no problem supporting that through the review process as well.
Do you have any guidance you can give us as to what priorities you set?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you. The second question relates to the Whangarino and whether you would have a view on whether that should have its own FMU.
I think Mr. Lawrence summed that position up quite well by saying that I'm not opposed to it in its own FMU. We've certainly been working quite extensively with regional council with Fund Kenya with Fish and Bay. Around from the issues arise and probably fix some botulism outcomes. So in short, we don't oppose having its own FMU. If there was a wetland complex that preserved one, it would certainly be fine.
So if the court were to make a fairly strong recommendation to the council to look at it and to include it in the next plan change, what would your view be of that?
We'd be comfortable with that.
Thank you. And just one last question relating to headroom for Tangata Whenua ancestral land. It's not provided for at the moment specifically, and could be a constraint to that land being enabled to change use significantly. Do you have a view on whether we should be looking at providing some guidance to the Regional Council on looking at that aspect in the next plan change?
My view is that I've got an open mind towards that consideration. I'm certainly been involved through the similar crisis, particularly aware of the dislocation of the elite. In terms of the petitioner's colleague earlier, the management seemed to arise as out of the similar crisis. And I think there are a unique set of circumstances that allow that consideration to be taken very seriously.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. Anything arising out of the court's questions? No? Thank you. Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Penton. Excuse. Thank you.
do solemnly, sincerely, and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you're about to give for this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Kilda, this is Dunmaker. You confirm your full name is Zari Dunmaker?
I do.
And you prepare two statements of evidence in this proceeding, one dated July 28th and one in August 2023.
Correct.
And you also participated in expert planning conferencing, including the specific points with this judge's session, and you signed both relevant joint statements.
Yes.
And you have the qualifications and experience as set out in your first statement of evidence.
Yes.
Do you have any corrections or amendments to your evidence? And do you confirm your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge? Please answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Ryan. I'd like to ask you about two topics. One is this question of oversteer and the potential for dual gateways for deer. I understand you've been here and heard some of the discussion around Section 293 and the range of issues there. And rather than talk about 293, if I approach it this way, your preference, I think, consistent with that of your client, is to have Plan Change 1 operative as soon as possible to get some runs on the board for the river.
Yes.
And so that is one of the lenses you apply when you look at the different approaches that could be taken to this gateway issue, isn't it?
Yes.
And so one of the options is to go down the nitrogen risk scorecard approach to the area as the sole gateway, and I think it sounds like you'd be comfortable with that.
Yes.
You'd also be comfortable with an alternative option if that could be done in an efficient way, is that fair?
Yes.
To assist, and this is something so you're aware and the court's aware that the council is considering and certainly looking at taking on board the guidance that has been provided so far, and I'm interested in your view as a planner about how one might go about framing up dual gateways in a way that that enabled, if that turned out to be necessary from a process perspective, that enabled the plan change to become operative sooner without the use of Section 293, but which sought to reduce the potential discrepancy between the way the two different gateways might work. Is that something you've been able to give any thought to?
I have thought about it, but I think that the challenge is, say, finding a way to make those gateways equivalent for the different tools, and I can certainly see a challenge in doing that. The nitrogen risk scorecard takes quite a different approach.
Thank you. And in terms of the stage that occurs after an activity has gone through the gateway, would you expect that it's useful at that stage for considering any applications to have potentially overseer available, even if it wasn't used for a gateway, it might still be useful as a tool for assessing the outputs of a particular activity?
Yes, and my understanding is that as the plan's out, it's probably will be an opportunity. It doesn't provide specific guidance on how you respect to it.
Yes. Thank you. Now, the second topic I want to talk to you about is setbacks, and in particular the way they work in relation to slope. And I think your council has already indicated a good summary of the regional council's approach to that point, and Mr. Trebilko's, I think, pragmatic approach to using 10 degrees because it would enable use of the MFB low slope maps. You're aware of that?
Yes.
And have you been here in the hearing to discuss some of the, to hear some of the discussion around the possibility that there might be some more detailed mapping based on LIDAR that might enable a more more accurate assessment of any given area on the farm.
I wasn't hearing that was specifically discussed, but I have
heard it discussed. Yes. And would you agree, in the event such mapping was available, it would be useful to make use of that through the provisions?
Yes, I think the more accurate mapping
is. Yes, and in terms of the different slope points, as my friend Mr. Ryan indicated, Mr. Trebilco was perhaps not wedded to 10 or 15 as a number, but in terms of practicality, his concern might well be resolved if some 15 degree mapping could usefully be used. Would you agree with that as well?
Yes, and certainly my
thank you, Ms. Redmond. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
No questions, thank you.
Mr. Pennell, any questions for Ms. Redmond?
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Dynamic.
Thank you, Your Honour. Just a couple of questions. Good afternoon, Ms. Rademacher. My friend's already taken you through some of the questions that I was going to address you on, so I only have a couple of outstanding ones. If I could take you first to paragraph 7.21 of your evidence in chief. And so these questions relate to the overseer and risk scorecard topic. So in that paragraph, the two sub-paragraphs, the two potential limitations of the risk scorecard. With the first one, in terms of the risk scorecard not including some other factors that go outside what occurs on the farm itself, firstly, would you agree that Plan Change 1 is about driving farmer behavioural change as one of the key tools to get us to where we need to? And so farm management techniques are therefore a key focus. And would you agree that the nitrogen risk scorecard focuses squarely and unashamedly on those farm management techniques?
I'm not an expert.
And were you here for the questioning of Ms. Kizak earlier today?
Yes.
And so did you hear when I took you through some of the current MFV guidance in terms of use of overseer? And so would you accept that that current guidance is that overseer numbers should not be used as absolute numbers? Then in terms of the second part of your 7.21 to 7.21b, in terms of the limitation of the risk scorecard of focusing on nitrogen rather than for contaminants, would you also accept that that's a limitation of overseer as well?
Yes.
So we don't have a tool or model that essentially addresses all four contaminants.
I'm not aware
of one, but it's not. And then in questions from my friend, you did raise the question in terms of dual gates of that equivalency between different tools. Would you agree though that in terms of use of overseer as a drafting gate versus the risk scorecard, they still are seeking to draft in the same proportions, so 25%, 50%, 25%, whatever the numbers end up being.
Yeah, I understand that they seek to pick up the same proportions but might not pick up the same individual properties.
Yes, thank you. Then one final matter,
Commissioner Hodges this afternoon raised some questions in relation to the longer term steps that might be required to get us to the 25 minor outcomes that we need to, and referred to allocations of nutrients. Now, in terms of tools at the moment, the Commissioner essentially said that Overseer is the tool that has been used elsewhere in New Zealand where there have been the need for allocations to be made. Would you accept that? Yes. And so in terms of looking ahead to whether it's the next policy review or one beyond that, as far as implementation and the stage of implementation of getting to where we need to in terms of determined by mana, would you agree though that if allocation is required, the particular tool that might be used would need to be determined at that stage? And so it could potentially be Overseer, but also could potentially be another model. And just going back to a question, or one of your answers earlier, as far as the provisions already contemplate the use of Overseer or other tools for other parts of Plan Change 1 rather than the drafting gate. That's your understanding of the provisions as they stand?
My understanding is that the provisions don't necessarily indicate any particular tool they require you to demonstrate various things in the way that it's demonstrated.
So essentially, within Plan Change 1, there are various different roles that a model or tool might be used for. So the drafting gate is one, but other aspects in terms of supporting a resource consent application, for example, it could well be a different tool that's used. And so equally that would apply in terms of any future allocative role that the planning framework took as well. So just because the scorecard or Overseer or whatever it might be is chosen as the drafting gate within Plan Change 1, that doesn't predetermine what the potential tool might be for any subsequent allocation model. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Burris, for Lockyer, questions? No, thank you. Federated Farmers, Mr. Matheson.
Thank you. Just briefly. Good afternoon. I just have two questions, two topics. At the beginning of the hearing, Commissioner Hodges asked a number of experts to prepare some further information in terms of stream lengths affected and etc. And that material is being put together. Does the River Authority have an expert, a water quality expert, or anyone that would wish to participate in that process of looking at that information, or would you be available to look at it otherwise?
We don't have a water quality expert
information
at the moment.
Right, but you'd be happy to look at it from a planning perspective.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So one of the, as I understand it, one of the matters that is being looked at as part of that work is to understand what improvement in sediment loss would arise from fencing and stock exclusion of up to 10 degrees. Is that something that would be of interest to the River Authority to understand what that improvement might be?
Yes, and I think also understanding the difference between 10 and 15 degrees would be of interest.
Yeah.
If possible, a position to change that.
Yeah, and if it turned out that the with fencing of up to 10 degrees with stock exclusion, that resulted in 24% decrease in sediment loss from the dry stock land, that would be a material improvement as far as you're concerned.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. All right. Secondly, on the overseer question, in terms of the dual options, Federated Farmers is obviously very, and Beef and New Zealand are very concerned to get these provisions operative as soon as possible, so that we can get on with making things better. And as part of, and they also called evidence from Mr. Newman, who's an open country supplier, open country dairy, who still uses overseer, still collects the data. And as part of the Federated Farmers provisions circulated, and I think there might be a copy there if you need them, unless somebody looks like they have stolen them, or maybe not, thankfully. So as part of the provisions circulated by Federated Farmers, they had added back in the overseer drafting gate option. Have you had a chance to have a look at that?
Not that specific, no.
Right. So, and I don't necessarily need to, if you haven't had a chance to have a look at it, that's fine. But if you go to page 38, of the provision, Schedule B, essentially adds back in the NRLR that you would have been familiar with from the decision version, and adds back in the nitrogen loss leaching rate, Table 1, and it essentially gives people an option to either use one gateway or the other. And the theory being that if people have their overseer number, they don't need to go out and get another overseer file, they'll have that number they can choose. So assuming that, and I think you raised the concern that we need to make sure the risks are comparable, and I think my friend asked you some questions about that. But from a drafting gate perspective, if the purpose of either of these gateways was simply to allocate farms as low, moderate and high, wouldn't really matter which drafting gate was used, would it, if the rough numbers in each category were similar?
If it was one or the other, I think the rough numbers would be similar, what I'd be interested in knowing is where farms wouldn't fall into the same spot, would they go to the more lenient or more stringent category, and would that impact the overall proportions in each of those?
Yeah, and I think to be fair, it would surprise me if somebody chose to go in a more stringent category. But even if someone did happen to have an overseer number and looked at both, and they chose to reduce their activity or so that they fell into an easier category, that's the behaviour you'd want to encourage. If it was changing on-farm practices to get into an easier category.
If it was changing their behaviour. Yep.
And yet even if there were some farmers at the margin that thought actually we might fall into an easier category, if it's at the margin and we're talking about 5,000 farms or 3,000 or 4,000, it was 10 or 20 across there that might fall on the margins, that's not going to be a material difference in outcome, is it?
I think it would depend on the number of farms that fell into that category.
Yeah. Okay. And then, as a drafting gate, we don't have a version, we don't have an issue with version change, do we? Because these numbers are baked in, they don't change, we don't need to go out and work out everyone's overseer number and worry about that changing in the future, do we?
I haven't considered how the overseer version impacts drafting gates.
Right, because in some plans, if you apply for consents over a long period of time, the version changes, becomes more of a problem. But if the role of the drafting gate here is simply to break farms into categories, it doesn't matter if the version changes in the future, or is it not something you're familiar with? Okay. No, that's fine. And then I think you did make the point to my friend that once you get through the drafting gate, obviously it may well be very useful at testing different farming systems and improvements on farm, but equally there's nothing to stop other tools being used as well. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for your answer.
You might just wait till the end of the answer. just for the future. thank you. Mr. Brothers?
10th at the lectern, so I'm not sure. I've been trying to watch everyone else's successful attempts, and hopefully I don't drop anything before.
Hold on to your laptop.
Yeah, that's going to be. Good afternoon, Ms. Rademacher. I act for Wairaki Pastoral Limited, and I only have questions in relation to Section 8 of your rebuttal evidence, which is around the reference date. So just to assist the court, to start with the context for these questions, the reference date, as you've called it there, is used in four locations throughout Plan Change 1. Firstly, in Policy 2E, then in Rule 3.11.4.9, which is the non-compliant activity rule, in Schedule A, and then in the glossary in terms of the definition of tangata whenua ancestral lands. Is that your understanding of its use? And so in terms of the last two of those examples, in Schedule A, the version of provisions that Federated Farmers put forward have removed the date from Schedule A, and I understand Mr. Trevalco agreed with that amendment last week, which he may not have been aware of. And then in terms of its use in the glossary, that is a matter that the iwi parties are taking up through the court. So the focus of my questions is on the use of the date in Policy 2E and in Rule 3.11.4.9. Now, in paragraph 8.1 of your rebuttal, you suggest that WPL is seeking that the date become either the date on which PC1 is made operative or the relevant application date. So I wanted to check your understanding of what is being sought by WPL now. So the request is that the October 2016 date, which is currently used, remains in place until Plan Change 1 is made operative, and then it's replaced with the operative date. Is that your understanding of the request?
It's slightly different to what I have here, but if that's
so that is what is sought by WPL in terms of Policy 2E and Rule 3.11.4.9. Does that correction change your opinion of the request?
No, okay.
I didn't think it would, but I just wanted to be clear. Now, I wasn't in the room last week, so I'm not sure if you were there or not. I didn't see you online, but were you in court for the hearing last week?
I was there for some of
Okay. Were you there when he explained how Rule 3.11.4.9 is intended to work? Okay. So he made it very clear last week that the rule itself does not authorise any discharges, and nor does it authorise the new land use occurring on the land. Is that your understanding?
Yes, my understanding is simply the land change.
The change, yes, okay. And can I check if that was your understanding at the time you wrote your evidence?
I hadn't probably narrowed it down quite that far.
Right.
But it wouldn't change.
So turning then to in your 8.3, where you say the requirement to obtain resource consent should not come as a surprise, it's probably so to speak, should not come as a surprise to any party that may have undergone change. Are you familiar with the Section 32 report regarding this rule from pre-notification? So that's available in the bundle behind you in volume 5 series. I'm not sure what colour it is. 501. It's the document starting 1364.
Steve.
Thank you, sir. So the document starts at 501.136.4 and the relevant page I'd like you to turn to is 501.1550. And the relevant paragraph is the second to last one that starts section 86B. Which confirmed it was to have legal effect from notification implemented immediately, that the intent was to protect from further degradation from notification while still allowing public consultation and input on the rule for the Schedule 1 RNA process of submissions and hearings. Do you accept that that process, the Schedule 1 process, is ongoing?
Yes.
And so parties are entitled through this process to seek the deletion of that rule or its amendment?
Yes, parties can seek that.
Now, on the following page, the first paragraph, towards the end, confirms that the provisions do not prohibit land use change, rather activities would need to seek resource consent. And it's not intended to remove the ability of landowners to operate existing activities on their land.
Yes.
So anyone who has undergone change since notification will either have obtained resource consent under this rule, operated in accordance with a certificate of compliance, or acted unlawfully. And so the concern, as you express it in your paragraphs 8.3 and 8.4, is that with the third of those, the unlawful activities?
Yes, the activities that haven't been unlawful.
Right. Thank you. I have no further questions, sir. Thank you. Good afternoon, Ms. Goldmaker. I wanted to ask you about paragraph 7.1 in your rebuttal evidence, which relates to your position on the consent term. Have you read the Ministry for the Environment Ashburton and Lakes report that's referred to Dr. Simon Stewart's evidence?
No, I haven't.
Alright, so you are supporting a duration of up to 10 years. Now, I just want to ask you about the word generally in that policy 7. Do you, Ms. Mark considers that the word generally might open up consent durations for longer than 10 years on an unspecified basis. What's your view on that?
My view is the word generally opens it up to a large term of longer than 10 years. I would expect that there would be exceptions basis, and there may be situations where that is appropriate, but that is a vast majority.
Now, you no doubt understand the issues with lakes catchments in terms of there are no interim target attribute states, there are long-term attribute states set at the bottom line, there's an issue with having to manage catchment lows in order to even maintain lakes. Would you consider removing that word for lakes catchments so that EPPs aren't locked in for longer than 10 years?
Don't think I have any issues with that.
Alright, thank you.
And I should have said that your council has also said you support a cut-off date of 2040.
I do support a cut-off date of 2040 to the extent that it resolves my concern with straining on for a long time. I understand that it may cause some issues for the regional council if it resulted in a large number of buildings expiring.
But nevertheless, you support.
Yes.
Thank you. Now, my friend Mr. Minhonak asked you some questions, as did Mr. Conway, about the overseer risk tool and the use of the Quantaria risk tool in the dual gateway. And we know, don't we, that PC1 is a policy package that reflects the start of a stage reduction of contaminants, and that future plan changes will be required that will require further reductions. Now, in relation to the use of overseer once you're through the gateway, you said to Mr. Conway that there are opportunities for its use, but it wouldn't be required. Could you have a look, please, at policy 10 of the PC1? So that policy talks about preparing for further diffuse discharge reductions in the future management regime, including potentially the allocation of diffuse discharges of contaminants in subsequent regional plans by collecting information and undertaking research. And then it says including but not limited to information about current discharges, and then it says developing appropriate modelling and other tools to estimate contaminant discharges. Have you considered whether in the decisions version the decision makers had in mind in that particular policy collecting information through the use of overseer and the impact of implementing that should overseer not be a requirement once you're through the gateway?
I haven't considered that. I imagine the council is drawing that from a range of information sources, including consumer applications.
You've said you're not an expert on the use of different tools to allocate the similar capacity of water in the future. Right, thank you. Now just finally on the Whangamareno Ipinu issue, Ms. Ma's evidence at paragraph 144 states a view that in her PC1 already sets out to manage the Whangamareno catchment as if it were a separate venue. And the change to separate out the Whangamareno as an FMU would not require substantial changes to the plan change, or such changes would be minor, and she's identified how to do those in her track changes. But nevertheless, the elevation in status will have a positive influence on future monitoring, reporting and accounting, and the management of offsets and compensation for the Whangamareno. In your view, imposing an FMU for the Whangamareno at this stage in PC1 would require very large changes to the plan change or minimal?
I consider that fairly minimal, the plan change, and it already draws out the Whangamareno to quite a degree.
And I suppose the other side of that is, do you consider there's been enough collaboration on that matter for this plan change to have probably not within you for this plan change rather than wait until the next 2024 process in terms of the collaborations between the parties?
I can't think of any impediments necessarily to doing that in this plan change. I'm not sure from a implementation perspective that would make much difference for PC1, but generally acknowledge that it may assist with implementation of some of those concerns.
Thank you very much. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Mitchell.
Do you have any issue with ending the use of overseer for CVP?
I'm happy with the being removed from the plan as proposed or being retained.
That's in general. FEPs as they apply to commercial vegetable production?
Generally, yes.
And to summarise, it's your view, isn't it, that any CVP expansion should be subject to minimum farming standards?
To the extent, if minimum farming standards were aimed to be incorporated into PC1 at this stage, I think for CVP, yes, it might be a change. But to my understanding, we don't have any at this stage.
Yeah, but one thing we do have is pretty detailed requirements in D2, Schedule D2, about FEPs, don't we?
Yes.
And do you know that all CVP, large or small, will have to comply with Schedule D2?
That's my understanding, basically the CVP
license. Yes, and you know that D2 is the more stringent of two types of FEPs, isn't it?
Yes.
And you obviously know that the D2 FEPs have to be certified.
Yes.
And there's auditing requirements. And you're familiar with the content of these D2 FEPs?
In a general sense, yes.
Yeah. One quite important thing that it has to cover is an assessment in sufficient detail to reflect the scale of environmental risk of whether the farming practices are consistent with each of the goals and principles, isn't it? So for all CVP, you're going to have that assessment undertaken, aren't you? And you also have to describe, don't you, any farming practices which aren't consistent with a particular goal or principle. Thank you for that. And you also have to keep records and evidence, basically, to demonstrate the achievement of goals and principles, don't you?
Yes.
And so what I'm putting to you is, in light of these pretty detailed and stringent requirements for all CVP, you don't really need the additional imposition of minimum farming standards for CVP, do you?
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think minimum standards provide a baseline. Minimum standards, other farming activities and minimum standards, including those that have to comply with Schedule D2. So I think it's really consistent.
Sure, but some other farming standards or farming activities don't even need a resource consent, do they? Whereas all CVP does. But despite that, are you saying, well, look, it's still my view, you would be better to have those minimum farming standards?
Yes.
know the council has other options open to it, like the ability to intervene if it's not happy with the content of an EPP. And you still think you need these minimum standards, even though the requirements for EPPs, they actually align with grower incentives, don't they? Because if you don't comply with what the EPP tells you to do, then you actually become a more restrictive activity status, don't you?
Sorry,
it's a bit in there. If you're a grower and you don't do what the EPP requires of you, then you can't enjoy the controlled activity status or indeed the discretionary activity status, can you? Well, don't you also then have to use that non-complying activity pathway?
My understanding is that in all instances you're doing what
it's said in the EPP. Yeah, and it's even an infringement defence, isn't it? At least for the part that requires you to comply with the bits that are in the regulations. So it's enforceable, isn't it, that the EPP, doing what the EPP requires them.
My expectation is that the written consents would include a condition requiring compliance with your EPP for resources.
Yeah, and so that's the sense in which I mean the incentives of the grower aligned with good practice, don't they? Because it's in the grower's interest to do what the EPP requires.
Yeah.
Are you going to be much longer, Mr. Mitchell?
No, I'm not. And are you aware that there's a range of other measures that can apply to growers, like the Good Agricultural Practice or GAP?
I'm aware there are other industry things, but I haven't reviewed any of those.
Okay, but in general terms, do you know that that's an industry assurance scheme at farm level?
I'm aware that they exist.
Okay, but do you know what they are? No. Okay. And I suppose you don't know that that on top of the NZ GAP, there's also an add-on called the Environmental Management Systems add-on. Do you know about that? No. Okay. Well, did you know that almost 100% of CVP land in Lower Waikato is registered with that additional add-on?
No.
Okay. Well, bearing all of that in mind, and the additional guidance and protections that provides, is it possible that could change your view about the need for minimum standards for all CVP?
While I don't understand what those tools are, they are non-regulatory,
not part of PC1, whereas the minimum standards would be, and therefore might be appropriate and consistent with other farming activities. But you're, so I take it you at least acknowledge that following a careful sort of studying of what the NZ GAP requires, it may well be that there are sufficient protections in practice, if not in a regulatory sense.
It could be, in which case perhaps those would be different.
And finally, I take it from your rebuttal evidence that you're not necessarily opposed to CVP rotation being allowed at the FMU scale.
Not necessarily, but it may require additional controls, additional measures to be put in place, and I don't necessarily understand what the effect of a large CVP will be to the opposite.
By effect, do you mean water quality effect?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, did you see the water quality joint witness statement where it was agreed that that the effects that there be would be very minimal at either the subcatchment or FMU level.
At that level, yes, I understand.
Yeah. Sure, and those are the sort of the very sort of effects that you'd need to identify and assess and deal with in the FEP, wouldn't you?
Potentially.
Yeah. So do you think that at least if done carefully, crop rotating at that FMU level might be a viable solution for growers, which doesn't negatively impact the environment?
I couldn't say. I think it would depend very much on the subcatchment
effect. Can you say that, even though the water science evidence is at the subcatchment level, no negative effect or negligible effect?
Sorry, it would depend on those localised impacts if they
were pushed on catchment. Yeah, and that's your sole reservation about whether we do it at the FMU level. Well, put it to you, you could do that very thing using the FEPs.
You could, but it wouldn't give the opportunity to decline the hand swings if the water quality is going to settle.
Okay, oh, well, those are my questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mortor. We're going to take the break now. How much do you have, Mr. Ferguson? Nothing. Right. Well, is there going to be any re-examination, Mr. Ryan? No.
What is that?
Do you have any questions? Do you have any questions? You have some questions. I have no questions. Well, there we are. I don't need to hold you in the cross-examination overnight, Ms. Ravenick. I tried my very best. Thank you very much for your evidence and your excuse. Just before we rise, there is an issue, as I understand it, and I think I may have dealt with this earlier, about the order of parties from here on. And I know that in the list, the way the hearing list was scheduled, it would have been Mr. Pennell, but I believe there may have been some discussion amongst the farming interests, Mr. Pennell, about what order parties should go in.
Yes, look, I'm available tomorrow morning, maybe into the afternoon. Given that perhaps Ontario to go next and if I'm back in time, I would be happy to follow.
All right.
Yeah, Ms. Gilbert's volunteering again. We're very happy to proceed tomorrow morning.
So you'll start tomorrow at 9:30?
Yep.
Right, I know Mr. Minhinnick headed off, but you'll let him know that yes, that's going to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Pennell, the plan would be you'd follow from Terra?
Yes.
And then we would have Lockheel. And then we'd have Federated Farmers.
Thanks, sir.
Very good. Well, that's reasonably straightforward. Any other housekeeping or other matter that anyone has? No? Very good. Well, 9:30 tomorrow then.